listeners out there. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. We appreciate all of our loyal listeners. But just in case you're a new listener to the show, let me give you a brief synopsis on everything that you've missed over the course of the last 18 months. So the three of us sit here in the same chairs, in the same office, in the same building, beside the same restaurant, in the same town, in the same state, talking about the same damn thing all of the time. That is pretty much everything you've missed since April of 2021. My name is Scott Wright. I am a mediocre journalist.
I'm Kelly Turner, and I'm not a doctor.
I'm Katie Givens, and I'm not a lawyer.
Which makes me think of something that I've been wanting to bring up. You know, she's going to law school.
Who's she?
She would be Katie.
Okay.
Sorry, Katie. I always do that, don't Katie I? Because I'm, it's like I'm talking to you, and or the two of us, or the three of us, and nobody else knows what I'm talking about.
Right, you're pointing to Katie. Katie
I pointed
is
to Katie.
Currently going to law school, and the only reason she did this was to screw up our intro.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because I figured out that as soon as she passes the bar,
yeah,
I'm going to start a campaign to have her disbarred.
Oh, good.
So that it doesn't screw up the whole thing.
Good. So, I'm right with you.
Yeah.
No worries. Silently. Yeah. I won't.
Well,
in front of Katie,
I'll take the lead on this.
We'll
don't worry about it.
We'll talk about it.
Yes. Shh. Okay. Don't say anything. She's sitting right there.
It's a long time coming. We got time, guys.
We've got time. We'll all be sick of each other before she passes the bar. Yeah. It takes a little bit of time. Speaking of the restaurant next door, there's a fantastic concert that's taking place this Friday. Mm-hmm. If you're listening to us on Wednesday or Thursday or Friday, you've still got time to get there. Driving and Crying.
Driving and Crying.
All right. You said you weren't going to do that, and then
I know.
You did it.
It's the worst band name to say when you're Southern, because it just makes it worse. Those long I's.
Yeah.
Dry.
So, no, do it again. Go on.
Driving and Crying.
You're supposed to drop
that's
the cheese.
That's worse. Driving. Yeah. And Crying.
That's it.
Yeah.
And that's just an N with an apostrophe.
I was about to say the actual band name has the apostrophe.
Yes.
Right? It does. Yeah. It does. So what's your favorite song from Driving and Crying?
I have too many favorite songs from Driving and Crying to pick one. How about you? Oh, boy. We're going to have to cut this.
No, we're not going to have to cut this. I think, let's see. I like Honeysuckle Blue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that might not be my favorite.
Okay.
I might have another favorite. I'm drawing a blank on the one that I... Dadgummit.
How long is this going to take?
It's not going to take long. I'm going to think of it. I promise. But anyway.
Katie's looking it up.
Katie, what's your favorite song?
I only know the one song. The I'm Going Straight to Hell song.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I was looking up when these songs came out, and I was right. It was before I was born, so I have an excuse.
Yeah, back in the,
what's the other popular
early
one?
To mid-90s?
There's Straight to Hell, there's Honeysuckle Blue, and then there's another one that's equally as popular. They have a lot.
I don't know. I'm just like reading off a list.
I know you really are. And y'all talk about something else, and I'll just figure it out. Because it's gonna bother me.
Well, we're supposed to talk about the Manson murders
again
today.
Yeah,
but while we're introducing that, then you can be looking up the song that it is that you think you
Fly
like.
Fly Me Courageous. Thank you.
Fly Me Courageous.
Would have been the next one on the list if I'd have just kept reading.
Darn it. I know. But that is Friday night. On Easy Street, mm-hmm. I should say it that way, right?
Yeah,
on
sure, why
Easy
not?
Easy Street.
Yeah.
Inside Easy Street Restaurant Bar Performance Hall, but it turns into just a performance hall at that time. Because
is that going to be 9 o'clock?
The concert starts at 9
o'clock.
Does it start at 7? My ticket said 7.
Doors open at 7.
Doors open at 7. Yeah, because we're gonna be open for dinner for the afternoon crowd,
okay.
But then we're going to shut everything down for a couple of hours. And then get ready for the big concert. There's going to be a limited menu that night. I was just next door having an alcoholic beverage with Shane.
Where are you now?
Might have been tipped
it's
off to
so
that.
It's so out of character for you.
I know. But anyway, so they're talking about the menu as we speak. So it's going to be a limited menu because it's going to be a full house. 200 people are going to be inside Easy Street on Friday night for Driving and Crying.
That was good.
So they're going to make it easy for the kitchen staff.
Mm-hmm.
So that we don't have the entire menu to prepare.
Now, I do have a few questions before I go.
Go on.
And since it's all about me, uh-huh. I'm just going to take this opportunity to ask those.
Why not?
Are they taking out all of the tables?
No.
So the tables will still be there as usual?
Yes.
Just, okay.
I think they may move some around, give more of a dance floor. Situation.
Okay. So if I want to dance, I've got
yes
more room.
And we all know
usual.
That you're going to dance.
Mm-hmm.
So
you know, I mean, yeah,
we're gonna make room. I think probably for people to do some moving and grooving.
Okay.
At Driving and Crying.
I'm excited.
Yeah, because we sold seats. So everyone who bought a ticket will have a chair if they would like to sit in one.
Okay. So someone can't just, I can't just have to stand up. I will have a chair to sit in when I'm tired of dancing.
Which you will need at some point. I've seen you dance. You do that Elaine Bennis full body dry heave set to music thing when you dance. So you're going to need to take a break at some point.
You have no idea what you're talking about. I'm an incredible dancer, Scott Wright.
That's not what your husband told me. Well, but he had been drinking when he said that.
We don't listen to him.
I don't. I'm glad you don't either.
So, Katie, are you going to be there?
Oh, I will be there.
Scott, you're there.
I am there.
Okay. I'm there too. So.
So we should we do like a live remote?
No, we're going to have our own table and we're going to, you know, do our own thing during this.
Might be a good time to sell some t-shirts.
Scott doesn't realize the importance of audio quality in a podcast. To all our listeners who don't know, Scott sometimes throws out these ideas like, hey, let's have some like jingling forks in the background and let's make it sound like we've dropped something. And we're like, Scott, no one wants to listen to that.
That's
no one
true. Wants to hear that. We have this conversation.
We have.
On a regular basis.
We have these nice Shure microphones. Like we have professional podcast equipment for our you know.
We have professional podcast equipment. We just really, don't have any professional podcasters.
Exactly.
It's just us.
So
these professional mics are stuck with the amateurs.
Yep. Yeah. All right. Well, so.
But if you hear clanging forks and chitty chat and all of that in the background, that would probably get on your nerves. If you, Scott, if you pulled up a podcast and it was clinging
and it sounded like I was in the kitchen at a restaurant.
Yeah. Would you continue listening?
I don't know. If the whole premise was that we are broadcasting live from a restaurant, I might at least get the reference.
Well, we also can't control what the crowd around us says or yells or... You know, if there's a table near us and they're drunk.
If you're worried about somebody dropping an F-bomb, look no further than the chair right beside you.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about if there's a table near us and they are talking about someone.
Uh-huh.
And
oh, I get it.
Pick it all up.
Then we're implicated in that. And we don't have a lawyer on staff yet. We're working on it, but not yet.
Not
to date.
We need to figure out. The catchphrase now, it has stressed me out. Thank you for that, Scott.
We've got time.
Now I'm stressed
out. Lots of time.
All right. So we, for the past two, or the previous two episodes, Manson Part 1, Manson Part 2. Scott, you did an incredible job on that. I know you have been obsessed with Charles Manson for the past few weeks because you've had to be.
That's okay. Fine.
You've had to eat, sleep, and breathe.
Yes.
Charles Manson and the Manson family. Ugh,
and he stinks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Trust me. It's
been a rough ride.
Yeah.
But what I should tell individuals who may have clicked on this one for the first time, you need to go back and listen to Manson Part 1 and Manson Part 2.
Yeah, nobody goes to the last chapter of a book and starts there unless you're an asshole.
Like you. You do that, don't you?
Only when I have to. Busted.
So,
go back and listen to the first two, and then today will make sense.
Right. Of just Manson. You don't have to pick up our podcast way back.
But we don't mind if you do.
If you want to do that, that's
fine. I mean, I gave everybody the whole synopsis of everything they've missed for the last 18 months, basically in the intro. So you're basically caught up. But for the last 2 weeks, it's been Manson.
And so the trial and everything that Katie's about to walk us through will make more sense if you listen to Part 1 and Part 2. And you'll know the Alabama tie. But as I understand it, there's also another
There is another one that Katie found last
week. Today. So we try to always bring that back home to Alabama. And sometimes we're successful and sometimes we're not. And that's okay because it's our podcast and we just kind of do what we
want. Yeah, we're half-assing this. So sit back and enjoy or not.
Exactly.
Because we're doing what we like.
I love it. Do we have any shout-outs before we finally get going today?
My leg's asleep. Is that a shout out? I should probably do this. No, I don't have any shout outs this week.
Okay. I don't believe that we do. I will double check that before we get to the end of the episode.
You half-assed listeners out there, give us some 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts and make sure and include your name in the remarks.
Yes. And we will give you a shout out here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I don't blame us. I blame our listeners.
I'll give a little bit of a shout out here. A couple of colleagues of mine have begun to listen and they've been very complimentary. So I would like to say a big hello to Terry and Cheryl for listening. Thanks. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, guys.
Mm-hmm. We appreciate that.
So, yeah. Appreciate
we've got some t-shirts. Let us know your size.
Yeah.
I'm still and trying to peddle those words. T-shirts.
You are.
They're just great. Sitting in a box.
They're great shirts. I love mine.
Yeah.
Anyways. All right, so we've done everything.
I'm done. All right, I'm going to sit back in this chair and listen to you guys tell me about the things that I don't know about the Manson/Tate-LaBianca case.
All right, take it away, Katie.
Well, last week, Scott had touched on that Susan, a lot of the information that we have on the details of these crime scenes come from a grand jury testimony by one of the members of the Manson family, Susan Atkins. So we're going to pick up in October of 1969.
Inyo County.
Inyo, okay.
Yeah.
Inyo County officers raided Barker Ranch, which is in a remote area south of Death Valley National Monument. 24 members of the Manson family are arrested. Various charges, arson, grand theft among the top two. Cult leader Charles Manson is found here. He is dressed entirely in buckskins. Fun fact.
Yeah, he's got that one outfit that he really likes. He wears it a lot. I'm sure it smelled terrific. Speaking of the smells.
Yikes. And Susan Atkins is among those that's arrested on this day. This is when she is in custody and begins to tell her story to another inmate named Virginia Graham. She even tells Virginia of a list of celebrities that the family had planned to kill. Among those included Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Tom Jones, Steve McQueen, and Frank Sinatra. So through an inmate friend of Virginia's, a man named Ronnie Howard, word of Atkins' testimony or her stories at this point that she's telling Virginia, they reached the LAPD. So they're like, oh, well, maybe we should go talk to this woman. About this same time, detectives on the LaBianca case are interviewing a member of the Straight Satan Bikers group named Al Springer, and he's a man that Manson had tried to recruit into the Manson family.
Mm-hmm.
So Springer tells detectives that Manson had bragged to him in August at Spawn Ranch after offering for him to have his pick among, there was like 18 or so naked girls just scattered about the ranch.
Yeah.
He's bragging to him about knocking off, in his words, knocking off 5 people.
So let me get this straight. The Manson, or Charles Manson,
yes,
was too much for the Straight Satan biker guy? Is that what you're saying?
He was for this particular.
This particular
there was
one,
another biker guy who hung out at Spawn Ranch before they moved to that, what did you call it, Barker Ranch or Baker Ranch?
Baker Ranch.
They moved out into the desert to the Baker Ranch, but before they did that, the Spawn Ranch is where the Manson family...
No, sorry, it is Barker Ranch. Okay. Barker Ranch.
The Manson family hung out at the Spawn Ranch, the movie ranch that we mentioned last week. And Charlie felt like it would be protection for the family if he got associated with one of the local biker gangs. And what'd you call them?
Straight Satans?
The Straight Satans. Satan. So they're individuals just like everybody else. There was one of the Straight Satans that spent some time at the Spawn movie ranch, but this Al Springer character, he was a little bit more of a straight-laced member of the biker gang, and he didn't want to have anything to do with
it.
He
was like, you're too much for me.
Yes.
Charles Manson. Got
it. Yes. He says that when Springer told the detectives that Manson had said that the Tate killers wrote something on the refrigerator in blood, something about pigs, mm-hmm, the detectives were like, huh, well, that is what happened, you know, things that most people wouldn't have known. And still, it struck them as odd that anyone would confess to several murders to someone that they barely knew. So they thought he was just kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm. They weren't used to dealing with Charles Manson level crazy just yet.
Yeah.
Well, and it is really shocking how common that is. Mm-hmm. When you have a pretty high profile murder, police have to filter through that. A lot of folks claiming that they are responsible for it, and they're not. And a lot of people are shocked by that. I know I was when I first got into looking into the true crime world and all that, but that's a really common thing. So they have to kind of filter through that.
Yeah.
And like Scott mentioned, it took another member of the Straight Satans, his name was Danny DiCarlo, to move the focus of the investigation right to Charles Manson, because DiCarlo also told police that he heard a Manson family member brag about, "We got five piggies." So it kept, you know,
that was the,
they talked a lot.
That was the Manson family's phrase for the establishment. Mm-hmm. It was the cops and the establishment. They used the same phrase, political piggies or pigs, mm-hmm. to describe people who they wanted to put an end to.
Okay.
And Manson had asked DiCarlo what to use to decompose a body. That's never good. Never a good question to get from somebody.
That I'm guessing lime was the answer, right?
We've all seen Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I think it's lime.
I don't think DiCarlo was telling the police that he knew when he gave that information.
Okay, probably not. That was probably wise.
We talked a little bit about Bugliosi, who was the chief prosecutor for this trial when it's coming up. But the day after he gets the assignment to be on this case, he joins a search of the Spawn Movie Ranch, where police gather 22 caliber bullets, shell casings, from a canyon used by family members for target practice. The next day, the search party moved on to the isolated Barker Ranch, like I'd mentioned earlier, which was the most recent home of the family on the edge of that Death Valley. In the small house on the Barker Ranch, Bugliosi saw there's a small cabinet under the sink where Charles Manson had been found hiding during that October raid, you know, where I said he was just wearing those buckskins earlier. Mm-hmm. On an abandoned bus in a gully, investigators discovered magazines from World War II, all containing articles about Hitler. Surprise, surprise.
Mm. Yeah, Charlie was a big fan of Adolf Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then this is where we've got our suspects that come into play. They take suspects of Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, Leslie Van Houten, Linda Kasabian, and Charles, or Tex Watson. They call him Tex. Susan Atkins was already in custody from that earlier raid, like we mentioned, and they promised to not seek the death penalty with her in return for testimony before the grand jury, plus consideration of a further reduction in charges for her continued cooperation if she continued to talk and answer their questions and be available to them during any trials that would come from her testimony. So this is when she gives that gruesome grand jury testimony that Scott talked about, where literally
she basically laid out the entire two nights of murder in Benedict Canyon and over on Waverly Drive in the Los Felix community, where she talked about the Tate murders and the LaBianca murders. She laid it all out on December the 4th or 5th, whatever day that was.
After the grand jury deliberated for all of 20 minutes and returned murder indictments against Manson, Tex Watson, Krenwinkel, Atkins, Kasabian, and Van Houten.
You said 20 minutes. It took them 20 minutes
to
figure this out.
In half a day, she said some pretty crazy things.
Yeah. She said some pretty incriminating things.
Incriminating as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Leslie Van Houten was picked up for questioning in California. Tex Watson was arrested in Texas. Patricia Krenwinkel was apprehended in Mobile, Alabama.
There's our other Alabama connection.
Our she was here staying with, was it an aunt she was living with? Mm-hmm.
She had attended classes at Spring Hill College, which was a Jesuit college in Mobile. And she had gone back to visit some friends or family members, and that's where she was picked up.
Yeah. And then Linda Kasabian, she surrendered to some local police. She was all the way in Concord, New Hampshire. Hmm. So they'd kind of scattered at this point. They were trying to get Tex Watson. They got everybody extradited back to California except Tex Watson, because he was in Texas. And Texas, you know, they like to handle their own. So there was like, it was kind of getting bogged down getting him extradited to Texas. So they go on with indicting the other four, and he's kind of left out of this first trial. So trial begins for the remaining four on July 15th, 1970. And first thing Charles Manson does is he requests to ask potential jurors a few simple childlike questions that are real to me in my reality, quote, end quote. That request was denied.
Yeah. Charlie, you can't talk to the jury.
Yeah.
Well, the thing was that Manson was allowed to be his own attorney for a few weeks.
What have we learned
before
about...
the judge said, this is a fucking terrible idea. You're not your own attorney anymore.
Yeah. What have we learned about people who try to be their own attorney on this show?
Always. They're usually nuts.
They're usually jailed.
Yeah.
Found guilty. Just ask Ted Bundy. Of course, we've not done Ted Bundy.
It was on Christmas Day of 1969 that the judge finally acceded to Manson's requests to be his own attorney. He said, fine, you want to be your own lawyer? Go for it.
Do it. Merry Christmas.
So for 3 months, 2.5 months, he got to be his own attorney.
And then he said, stop this madness.
Katie's going to get there, but that's what happened initially.
Gotcha. Yeah. All right.
During like all the voir dire process and, you know, the picking of the jury and the witnesses and everything like that, Manson just has this fixating, penetrating stare. He stares at Judge on this trial, his name is Judge Older. He stares at him for hours, just without moving. He's just got this stare.
And that's always a good idea, to stare down.
Well,
the
it
judge.
Worked on all those girls. He's thinking it might work on the judge, but he's going to be disappointed there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And then the next day, that stare gets fixated on Bugliosi.
Mm-hmm.
After getting Manson's stare treatment for that day, Bugliosi takes advantage of a recess and he slides his chair on next to Manson and he's asked him, he's like, what are you trembling about, Charlie? Are you afraid of me? And Manson responds, Bugliosi, you think I'm bad and I'm not. He went on to tell Bugliosi that Atkins was, in his words, just a stupid little bitch who told a story to get attention.
Yikes.
Mm-hmm.
And after a month of this choosing of the jury, a jury of 7 men and 5 women are selected. And the jury was told that they'd have to be sequestered. Mm-hmm. But they knew it'd be for a while. They had no idea exactly how long.
They didn't know it was going to be this long.
Yeah.
Oh, can you imagine?
I think the judge told them 3 months they would be sequestered.
Turned out to be 225 days longer than any previous jury in history.
Yeah.
I would be so mad.
And they sent them, well, the good news for the jury was they sent them to the Ambassador Hotel, which was already kind of on its way down in Los Angeles at the time. It turned out to be in a neighborhood that wasn't as economically viable as some of the other parts of LA came to be. But that's where Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in June of 68. It was the same hotel where, after he'd won the California primary, he walked back through the kitchen to get out, and Sirhan shot him in the kitchen at the Ambassador. So already bad things have happened at the Ambassador Hotel.
Mm. Opening statements begin on July 24th, and Manson enters the courtroom sporting a freshly cut bloody X on his forehead, signifying, he said in a statement, that I have X'd myself from your world. So the crazy begins.
Yeah, the crazy begins. And then wasn't it the next day that the 3 girls showed up in the courtroom with an X on their foreheads as well?
Oh, my.
Bugliosi, in his opening statement for the prosecution, indicated that his principal witness would be Linda Kasabian, who's a Manson family member who accompanied the killers to, you know, that the Tate and the LaBianca residences. Kasabian was the lookout, right?
Yes, the lookout.
She's the one who never entered the house.
At Cielo Drive. Did she ever enter the LaBianca house?
No, she did not.
Okay. All right.
So prosecution turns to Kasabian with a promise of immunity for her testimony. Because at this point, Susan Atkins, we think, probably threatened by Charlie or just told by Charlie.
Or, yeah, persuaded by Charlie.
Yeah, that she announced she would not testify at the trial.
So everything she said in that grand jury testimony, she's going to repudiate. I'm not going to have anything to do. I'm going to deny everything that I said.
She was like, I was lying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and Bugliosi says in Helter Skelter, thank God that this happened, because he had a real problem with giving Susan Atkins a reduced sentence. Mm-hmm. In her case, it was going to be second degree murder.
Right. She wasn't getting immunity.
Right.
Atkins. There was never a promise of that. They because took the death penalty off the table. And
yeah, she had been involved in it. So Bugliosi really did not want to give her this deal, but it was the best description that he had until she recanted her testimony in May. And they knew that Linda Kasabian had not entered the residence, but had been told and knew pretty much everything that happened. So Bugliosi loved the fact that he got to used Kasabian's testimony in court instead of Atkins, and they gave her immunity.
Yeah. And Linda Kasabian, just, I don't want to sound, I don't know how this is going to sound, but Linda Kasabian just talking and her whole demeanor, it comes across, I mean, just less crazy.
She wasn't.
I hate to use that word.
She had not been indoctrinated by Charlie Manson.
No, she was not. She was not as brainwashed. And yeah. Honestly, Susan, I mean, Susan has some mental illness.
She was shit nuts crazy the day she died in 2009.
Mm-hmm. She's long history of mental illness, and then the brainwashing on top of that, the persuasion by Manson was worse. So it probably did work out better for him that Linda Kasabian was able to.
She was more believable, I think, as far as the prosecution was concerned, right?
She was more relatable to a jury.
Yeah.
Then
she had,
Susan.
She showed remorse. She showed.
She was very remorseful.
Sorrow.
She was a better witness. I mean,
and they said, I remember reading in Helter Skelter when Susan Atkins got off that stand, that grand jury testimony in December of 69, nobody could believe that not one time had she shown any sorrow, any remorse.
Mm-hmm.
She just told it like she, Bugliosi says this, like she was telling about what happened to her that day at school.
Yes, and she even referred to the 18-year-old in the truck that as a thing.
That's the thing I saw when they showed her a picture of Stephen Parent's dead body in the car outside the gate at CLO Drive.
Yes, and so then you have Linda on the stands, and like you said, Katie, she's a better witness. Mm-hmm. And she's actually, Linda is sorry for her part in this.
Yes.
Very sorry. And so the jury was able to relate to that and have some sympathy for her. And she was believable.
Mm-hmm.
Kasabian told the jury that no family member ever refused an order from Charlie. She said, we always wanted to do anything and everything for him. But then on August 3rd, she's still testifying on this day. And Charlie decides, he stands up before the jury. He holds up a copy of the Los Angeles Times with the headings, Manson guilty, Nixon declares. Mm-hmm. And the defense immediately moves for a mistrial on the grounds that the headline prejudiced the jury against the defense.
Mm-hmm.
But Judge Older's like, no. Denies that motion after each juror states under oath that he or she would not be influenced by the president's reported declaration of guilt in this newspaper heading. So that doesn't last long.
But you can't blame him for trying that one.
Well, no, it's not the last time Richard Nixon shoved his foot all the way down his throat.
Good Lord. Mm-hmm. All right.
Testimony corroborating that of Kasabian came from several other prosecution witnesses, most notably the other women that Atkins confided in while she was incarcerated. Like we mentioned, the Virginia Graham. Other witnesses described receiving threats from Manson, evidence of Manson's total control over their lives, of family members, or conversations in which Manson had told of the coming of Helter Skelter. So that's all coming from witness testimony that's corroborating everything Kasabian's already said during her testimony.
And the jury can see this. I mean, they see him walk in with his ex, and then the next day they see the girls come in with their ex.
Yeah, they're not doing a very good job of hiding the fact that they are at his beck and call and are willing to do almost anything and everything that he tells them to do.
Right.
If they're trying to put on a competent defense, it's falling apart day by day.
Yes.
Yeah. The singing
that
the girls do.
Yeah.
I'll try to share. I've went down a TikTok rabbit hole, and that's one of the
things that
you get is the creepy videos of the girls, you know, singing down the halls of the courtroom.
Yeah, being walked into the courtroom at Department 104, and they're all singing in unison with their little jail dresses on.
What are they singing?
Some song that Charlie has written that he has sung to them around the campfire for the last year and a half.
Because Charlie was a musician.
He wasn't very good.
Mediocre musician at best.
My kind of musician.
So we've established that. Okay, so that's what they were singing.
Yeah.
All right.
And then we've got 19-year-old Paul Watkins, who was Manson's foremost recruiter of young women. He provided key testimony about the strange motive for the Tate and LaBianca murders, including its link to the Book of Revelations.
Charlie's whole thing is Scientology, the Bible, and the Beatles.
Yes.
Those are his three things. I mean, the White Album came out. He's linking Revelations into it, and he's talking about Scientology because he picked up some key phrases, and I don't know anything about Scientology, but several times Bugliosi mentions that it's not too hard to trace back some of the things that Charlie is saying to his followers to the school of Scientology or to the church of Scientology.
Well, and they have publications as well that he could easily have read or picked up and just taken from that too. So they publish things.
Yeah,
too.
I don't
they
know have, if he dabbled in it or books. Not, but yeah.
Yeah, I think he took a lot from what was around him and made it his own.
Exactly. That's exactly what he did.
Because Watkins testified, you know, that he always was talking about Helter Skelter, constantly talking about this Helter Skelter.
He was absolutely obsessed with that Beatles album.
Well, he used the phrase Helter Skelter before the White Album came out. So in Charlie's mind, what happened when the Beatles album came out in late 69, early 70, it just reinforced everything that he had already believed himself and was espousing to his followers.
Mm-hmm. And what
does, it was confirmation to him.
What does Helter Skelter mean? Because the Beatles use that. Manson uses it.
That came out in 68, the Beatles album.
Okay, 68.
Is this a common phrase that people say or said?
Well, in England, a Helter Skelter is a slide at a county fair. Like you would get a burlap sack and slide. That's what a Helter Skelter is in Great Britain, according to what I read. But to Charles Manson, Helter Skelter, Katie, correct me when I get this wrong, Helter Skelter meant the black-on-white race war that he was certain was coming. Mm-hmm. And when it didn't come when he wanted it to or when he needed it to, he felt like that what he could do to institute that to begin was to have these crimes committed at the Tate residence and the LaBianca residence. And then they would go and hide out at the Barker Ranch in the desert and wait on the blacks and the whites to kill each other. And then they would swoop up at the end and rule the world. That was what he told his followers, and that's what they believed.
But what the Beatles meant by it was chaos.
Mm. Yeah.
That's look it up. Because I read one article, I think Refinery29 did an article on the meanings versus each other. And the Beatles song was just talking about chaos.
Yeah,
they wanted to do something that sounded different than anything else they had done.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like we would say here, topsy turvy, or
exactly
fruit basket turnover.
Yeah,
yep.
You know, but that's not as cool sounding as Helter Skelter.
Not at the time.
You know, but it's also that was Helter Skelter is a British type.
It was a common phrase in the British lexicon at the time.
Okay, got it.
On November 16th, 1970, after 22 weeks of testimony, the prosecution rests its case. So when the trial resumes 3 days later, so prosecution rests its case, they give a 3-day break, defense comes in, it's their turn to pick up. It's how trials work, if you don't know. The defense tells the courtroom, without calling a single witness, they say the defense rests.
Yep. Is this when Charlie's still his own lawyer?
No.
He hasn't been his own lawyer for some time now. The court keeps pushing local defense attorneys onto him, and he bitches and moans about every single one and tries to get them all thrown out, but he is not his own lawyer at this point.
And so finally the lawyer's like, just forget it. Defense rests.
Well, they say the defense rests, and the three female defendants began shouting that they wanted to testify.
They're going against Charlie?
Yes.
Ooh.
They're going against their legal representation.
Yes. They're going, yes.
Their
lawyer's saying, shut the fuck up. The best thing you can do is keep your mouth shut.
Just be quiet and let's hope that they just think you're insane and they don't give you the death
penalty. But the girls all want to talk.
They all want to talk. They each have their own attorney.
Okay.
In chambers, attorneys for the women explain that although their clients want to testify, they are strongly opposed to that, believing that they would still be under the powerful influence of Manson and that they would testify that they planned and committed the murders without Manson's help.
They're going to kick Charlie out of the courtroom. I mean, they're going to kick him back into the street. That's their plan, right, Katie? They want to take the blame for the whole thing and let Charlie off the hook.
So he can finish his work.
I guess.
That's what the attorneys say anyway, that they're like,
that's what the attorneys
believe.
They're
just going to get up there and say that he didn't do anything, that this was their idea, he wasn't there, he wasn't there.
He didn't do anything other than brainwash them.
Yeah, but Bugliosi's whole argument about what the motive is.
Mm-hmm. It's Charlie's motive.
Is Charlie's motive.
Yeah, it is. He's right. I'm glad he took that route because Manson would have just continued to do this.
There was that concern.
Yeah. All right.
So they return to the courtroom and the judge is like, their right to testify takes precedence over the objections from their counsel to not testify. So he's like, they have a right to testify.
Hop on up here and talk.
Yep. And I mean, you know, they're testifying under oath. So if they get up there,
if they perjure themselves, they're in trouble for that too, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's like, come on up if you want to.
Come on down.
Yeah.
So first one up is Atkins.
Okay.
Susan Atkins, and she's sworn in as a witness, but her attorney, whose name was Dave Shin, he refuses to question her.
He's like, I don't have any questions for her.
So, returning to chambers, one defense attorney complains that questioning their clients on the stand would be like aiding and abetting a suicide.
Good Lord.
So, the next day comes another surprise, because the next day, Charles Manson announces that he wants to testify, and he's going before his co-defendants. So he testifies first without the jury being present. They kick all the jury members out.
Because they're like, we just don't know what he's going to say.
So that potentially excluded testimony relating to evidence incriminating the co-defendants and all might be identified before it prejudices the jury. Because you can't unring a bell. You hear that all the time.
Exactly.
You cannot unring a bell. So he gets up there and he talks for over an hour. It's full of just nuts stuff. I mean, and at the conclusion of Bugliosi's brief cross-examination, like he gets up there and he says what he wants to say, and then Bugliosi cross-examines him. The judge asks Manson if he now wants to testify before the jury, because I mean, he's just got up there and he's just spouting nonsense. He replies, I have already relieved all the pressure I had, and he leaves the stand and he looks at the counsel table to the three women, and he says, you don't have to testify now.
Okay.
So,
alrighty.
Yep. There's one last weird thing that happens. So there was no more testimony from any of them. When the trial resumes on November 30th, following Manson's testimony, Ronald Hughes, who was the defense attorney for Leslie Van Houten, he didn't show up.
He just doesn't come to court.
A subsequent investigation reveals that he had disappeared over the weekend from a camping trip he took in the remote Sepsi Hot Springs area, northwest of Los Angeles.
Oh my gosh, where is he?
It's widely believed that he was ordered murdered by Manson for his determination to pursue a defense strategy at odds with that favored Manson. So he didn't want to go with what Charlie wanted to do. So
the family had him killed. That's the speculation.
Found? Was he ever found?
He was.
I mean, he was murdered, but yeah, it's because Hughes made it clear that his hope was to show that Van Houten was not acting independently as Manson had suggested.
Yeah, Ronald Hughes was Leslie Van Houten's attorney. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me get this straight. He goes on a camping trip
over
the weekend.
The weekend before the shit's going to hit the fan in the courtroom.
And he gets murdered on this camping trip.
That is the speculation.
How did he die? What happened to
him? That's the thing. They found him a couple of months later, his body. Katie, you got this?
Go ahead.
They found his body a couple of months later, and he was so far gone at the time that an autopsy didn't reveal any specific cause of death.
So I guess technically we don't know that he was murdered.
Yeah. But in 1976, Leslie Van Houten's guilty verdict was thrown out by an appeals court in California because the judge did not declare a mistrial for her because her defense attorney didn't show up for the last day of court.
Why in the world would he not have declared that for her?
It took 2 years for her to be reconvicted of those crimes. And so she ended up in jail where she was supposed to be. But Bugliosi says in Helter Skelter that in 76, when this all came up with the appellate court, that somebody called him and anonymously said, I'm a member of the Manson family, or I know someone who's a member of the Manson family, and they had Ronald Hughes killed.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
But that Which Bugliosi says, we can't prove it, but that's what I was, somebody called me and told me that.
And they thought it from the beginning when he was.
Sure,
that's just
of
very
course.
Fishy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah, so, one last indignity for anybody who tried to give these asshats what little justice they were entitled to. Mm. A fair trial, sure, but...
Yes, a fair trial and a competent defense.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's what this guy gets for trying.
Ugh. Mance's defense attorney at the time's name is Irving Kinnerick, argued to the jury that the female defendants committed the Tate and LaBianca murders out of a love of the crime's true mastermind. The guy who's not there, Tex Watson, the guy who's in Texas, they are claiming he's the true mastermind behind these crimes and these women are in love with him.
And so that's a pretty good defense coming
it is.
From that attorney. How is Charles, going along with this or is he?
He's fighting Kinnerick at every corner of the road.
I just did not see him standing for that being put out there. No, no, no. They're absolutely devoted to me.
Yeah,
right. You know, I just didn't see him standing for that.
But Charlie's already testified. He's got his testimony out of the way. So he's kind of.
That brief statement that he, or that statement that he made.
That hour long rambling.
That word salad.
Yes.
Basically, word salad.
Yeah.
And so Tex, so they're saying, oh, it was all Tex. And that's what the lawyer's trying to say. Charlie's not having it. Is Charlie in court arguing with his lawyer while he's saying
all
of this?
He argues with the judge. At one point, he jumps over the table with a sharpened pencil and tries to attack the judge and screams out, in the interest of Christian justice, you should have your head lopped off.
That will get you a guilty verdict. Every time.
He did that in front of the jury. So they hauled his ass into the holding cell next door and piped in the sound from the courtroom in a speaker so he could hear what was going on. That happened several times. They took the girls out. They took Manson out. There were a lot of times when they just got so unruly that the judge said, get the fuck out.
Mm-hmm. This is a circus.
It was a circus.
But also, I go back to what I said last week. It's very evident that the individuals that you are dealing with here are mentally ill.
Something is not right.
And so you got to start wondering, is that going to be difficult? Is that going to actually hurt your case? Like, I know these people need to go away, but can you absolutely say death penalty? Well, I guess the question
is, I don't want to spoil the surprise.
But I guess the answer is, yes, you can.
In 1969 in California, when you've done this, it turns out you can.
You can. Okay.
Yeah, because the only other thing he's arguing is that Manson's being persecuted because of his lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. You know,
they don't bring up any crazy talk.
Well, Bugliosi is very complimentary of this Irving Kinnerick because he's a very obstructionist defense attorney, and I'll make this short.
He is objecting to
every single thing. I mean, Bugliosi says it takes him a couple of days to get through his opening statement because everything that he says, Kinnerick objects to. In fact, there's one example of another case where a case is just beginning and Kinnerick objects to someone stating his own name for the court because he says his mother told him that's his name and that's hearsay. That's just one example of what Irving Kinnerick does.
Well,
one of the reasons why this thing takes 7 months is because of Irving Kinnerick.
Well, Irving, you have a birth certificate.
He spends a couple. Irving Kinnerick spends a couple of weekends in jail, having been accused of what's the term, Katie, for contempt of court.
Yeah.
The judge sentences him to spend the weekend in jail, and this is a Friday afternoon. You get your ass to jail. I'll see you at 7 o'clock Monday morning.
We've had enough.
I'm done with you being an idiot in my courtroom.
You've taken up.
He does that
much.
A couple of times.
If only Judge Ito had done that.
Oh, thank God. Don't we wish that he would have?
Yeah, that's a story for a previous.
Maybe
day.
Ito should have read about what Judge Older did in the Manson trial.
Maybe so. I don't know. I kind of wish he had declared the mistrial though for
Van Houten.
For Van Houten. I mean, not because I wanted her to.
Well, that's what the appellate court did.
Right.
Yeah,
it got fixed.
It was right,
but it
Anyways, well,
his Kinnerick's ending argument lasts 7 days.
Mm-hmm. Good gosh!
And it prompts the judge to say, you know, this is no longer an argument. This is a filibuster. We're not doing this.
I mean, where the again? I go back. If I'm the jury, I'm so angry right now.
At some point, Manson yells, and I forget exactly what he said, but he is yelling at Kinnaric as well, saying, will you please stop doing this? You're making it worse.
Well, and that just, there's some sense.
That's your argument right there, because all these people are ready to go home. In Charles Manson's mind, I've already been convicted. I was convicted the day I walked in. I'm going to jail. I'm going to prison. I'm going to the gas chamber for the rest of my life. Let's just get this over with. You're making it worse, my attorney, that I don't even want to begin with, that the court forced on me.
Mm-hmm. I don't even like you.
Yeah.
The judge doesn't even like you. Nobody likes you.
Nobody likes Irvin Kinnaric. I'll bet his wife is in hiding somewhere, or at least she was.
Gosh.
Sorry.
I'm going to end this trial on up, but last thing I want to say before we get into sentencing is that Bugliosi has a pretty good summation of his case at the end, and he talks about how Manson was this person who sent out from the fires of hell at Spawn Ranch three heartless, bloodthirsty robots, and unfortunately for him, one human being whom he called the little hippie girl, Linda Kasabian. And Bugliosi ends this with a roll call of the dead. He says, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we have Sharon Tate, Abigail Folger, Wojtek Wrykowski, Jay Sebring, Stephen Parent, Leno LaBianca, Rosemary LaBianca. They're not here with us in this courtroom, but from their graves, they cry out for justice.
That's really good.
That was, yeah, I got, yeah, hair standing up.
Really good.
And so the jury deliberates for a week, and it returns its verdict on January 25th, 1971. They find all defendants guilty on each count of first-degree murder. After hearing additional evidence in the penalty phase of the trial, the jury completed its work by sentencing each of the four defendants, or they offered their suggestion for sentencing. They sentenced them all to death. And as they read the verdict, the clerk reads the verdict, Manson's shouting, you people have no authority over me. Which is not true.
I mean, okay.
Yeah.
The Patricia Krenwinkel's yelling, you have judged yourselves. Susan Atkinson is yelling, better lock your doors and watch your own kids. I mean,
so we decide that we're going to
threaten. The nuttery continues.
We're going to threaten the jury.
Yep. Van Houten says the whole system is a game.
Okay.
But the trial's over after 9 months. It's been the longest and most expensive in American history.
Good gosh. Go to jail, will you please? Well, Do not pass go. Just go to jail.
Until Lance Ito got a hold of the OJ trial.
Yeah.
And then he screwed that up.
Ugh.
But then we got a California Supreme Court ruling in 1972 that declares the state death penalty law unconstitutional. So they never actually get, any of them gets the death penalty because it is now unconstitutional in California. So they are all in maximum security sections and they're serving life sentences. Of course, Scott mentioned earlier, Susan Atkins has died of brain cancer.
Yeah, she died in 2009 and then I think Manson died in 2017. Yep, and as far as I know, Van Houten and Krenwinkel are still incarcerated. Yes. And is Tex Watson still alive? Because the story about Watson is they get him back to California in September.
Okay, mm-hmm. Finally.
But he's ruled incompetent to stand trial, and they send him to our old friend, Atascadero.
Oh, my gosh.
He spends some time in there, but it's February of 71 before he's ruled competent to stand trial. He goes on trial in August of 71, and in October of 71, he is found guilty and is also, I guess, Katie, sentenced to death because the Supreme Court has not ruled against.
Same thing, and it gets commuted to life, too.
So commuted to life as well.
Did they release him from Atascadero?
Yeah, he spent September of 71, I'm sorry, September of 70 to March of 71.
To February
of 71, and they declared him competent to stand trial.
They didn't say he was cured. They just said he was competent.
Competent to stand trial.
Okay.
And so he did.
Because we know they freed someone they said was cured.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Would that be Edmund Kemper III?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be.
Oopsie.
But yeah. No, he's in prison in San Diego currently.
Okay, so he's still alive.
Mm-hmm. Is he the only one still alive?
No.
I think Leslie and Patricia are both still alive.
The only ones that have passed are Susan and Charles, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, Charles passed, was it a couple of years ago?
17.
Been a little bit longer.
And there are, I mean, Leslie and Patricia have been granted parole a few times, and then the governor of California has come down and said, no.
I think that amongst other people, the family of Sharon Tate lobbied the state government and the legislature to pass a law that allowed the governor to overrule the parole board and rescind someone's parole if they had been granted by the parole board. And that's happened at least once, right, Katie?
Yeah.
With one of them, not both of them.
And which governor is it?
It was Jerry Brown initially. Gavin Newsom, right? The current governor.
It wasn't Arnold. I know that.
Maybe it never came up. Arnold.
I bet it Arnold just never came up.
Probably not.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah,
think any governor would allow those two to walk free.
No.
Yeah.
So do we want to know a little bit about Charles's childhood and to kind of see where
Do we want to try to explain this?
Well, I just have a little bit of information because I was charged with, you know, looking into, since I'm not a doctor and not a, you know, a psychiatrist, I was charged with, you know, looking into Charles's childhood and just to kind of see, how does someone get to where they are from when they're born and then to get to that ranch that day and
say it's time for Helter Skelter.
Yeah, the behavior and all that. So I don't know if I'm going to shed any light on the subject for you, but I can give you a little bit of background of how Charles was brought up. So he was born to a 16-year-old girl named Kathleen Maddox on November the 12th, 1934 in Cincinnati, Ohio. Before being called Charles, the baby was known as No Name Maddox for a few weeks. He was No Name Maddox.
Wow.
And then finally, he was named Charles Mills Maddox. Colonel Walker Henderson Scott Sr. was his father, and he was stationed at an army base nearby, but never had anything to do with him and did not want anything to do with him. When Kathleen, who was Charles's mother, told the colonel that she was pregnant, he was done. He was done with her. Kathleen soon began dating William Eugene Manson, and this is where Charles gets his last name.
He had to get it somewhere.
Mm-hmm. William Manson would go on drinking binges, and he would go missing for days, and then they didn't stay married long. I told you Charles was born in 1934. Well, Kathleen and William divorced in 1937.
Okay. Yeah.
So he was around long enough just to give Charles his
name. Give him a name.
Mm-hmm. Kathleen would often leave Charles to fend for himself or with basically anyone who would keep him, and she would be gone for days on a binge.
I heard she was a loose woman.
Yeah.
Drank a lot, slept around.
Yes. I think that's a little bit of a dated term, loose woman, but you know.
I'm using terminology from Helter Skelter.
That's terminology from there.
Yeah. Was she a sex worker?
I think at times, if it's so benefited her.
Yeah, if it paid the bills or put groceries on the table.
Yes. Now, Kathleen received a 10-year sentence in prison for armed robbery in 1939. So Charles goes to live with his aunt and uncle in West Virginia. Kathleen was paroled in 1942 and soon could not deal with Charles. So she sends him to the Gibault School for Boys in Terre Haute, Indiana. He was kind of a behavioral problem at this point.
I'll pretend to be surprised if you like.
Okay. So this school was for juvenile delinquents and it was run by Catholic priests. Now Charles is going to run away from this school twice.
I think I would have as well.
The first time he's going to go back home and then his mother's going to send him right back. So he won't make that mistake the second time. The second time he left, he went to Indianapolis and he earned money by burglaring various places at night. Stores, things like that. And then that's how he would survive. When he was caught, he was sent to Boys Town in Omaha, Nebraska. There, he stole a vehicle with another boy there and they took off. More robberies, etc.
Were they headed anywhere? I remember reading that and I always wondered, were they headed somewhere in particular or
just
not?
Just away from there. He was caught and he was sent back to the Indiana Boys School. Now, Manson claims he wasn't sent back. He was sent to the Indiana Boys School because he left Boys Town in Omaha.
Different boys school.
Yeah. Then he's in the Indiana Boys School. He claims It is at the Indiana Boys School that he was beaten and raped pretty regularly there.
Mm.
He was a small kid.
He was very small for his age.
Yeah.
He failed two escape attempts there and finally succeeded in 1951. He was then sent to the National Training School for Boys in D.C. and was evaluated and determined to be, quote, aggressively antisocial, end quote. He was transferred to the Natural Bridge Honor Camp, and he was caught there raping another boy at knife point. He was transferred to the Federal Reformatory in Petersburg, Virginia. There, Manson was caught raping other boys. He was then transferred to a maximum security facility in Ohio. In 1954, he was released to live with his aunt and uncle, and he was 20 years old at the time. Charles had more run-ins with the law and was eventually released from prison in 1967, and this is where the family begins.
Yeah.
The quote, family
begins. Yeah, that was on March the 21st, 1967.
So this was Charles's life. Charles's life. No, and it did not. He was out of prison in 67, and then we have these events that happened.
I mean, this trial begins in 70. He's arrested in 69, so he is able to get this family together and brainwash all these women in the span of less than 2 years.
Yeah, he goes straight to Haight-Ashbury. And remember, 67 was the summer of love, right? Mm-hmm. And we had, at one point, there were 75,000 kids. I think we talked about this last week or the week before. Young people from all over the country who had gone out to California, to San Francisco, to Golden Gate Park in the Haight-Ashbury district to experience the summer of love. And there's one quote where Charlie says, I think he says it to Squeaky Fromm, who was the second girl that he picked up after Mary Bruner. She was the first member of the Manson family. But he says to her, and while he's picking her up and convincing her to join the family, I'm the gardeners and you girls are my little flowers. Mm-hmm. Or some words to that effect. And that's how he does it. He just convinces them that whatever it is that's missing in their lives, maybe they're one of his patent excuses or methods of picking a girl up is, I'll bet you're here because you don't like your dad or you have daddy issues. Mm-hmm. That's a very easy thing to do for a girl that's sitting all by herself, 17, 18, 19 years old on a park bench in Haight-Ashbury, wondering where her next meal's going to come from.
Mm-hmm.
And try the daddy issue thing.
And he was happy to try to be that father figure.
And that's what he did. He filled in and he knew all of this lingo and all these persuasive methods of talking to people because he'd been incarcerated for 17 of his 32 years.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew the jail lingo and he knew how to convince people to leave him alone because otherwise he was going to get raped in prison every day.
Yes. And you see, Charles's life is very tragic.
Yes.
From the beginning, Charles is no name.
Yeah.
And then kind of makes a name for himself.
The day that he was released on March the 21st, 1967, he begged the authorities at that jail, I'm institutionalized. Mm-hmm. Please don't throw me back out into public.
He didn't know how to live.
I want to, jail is my home. I want to stay here. They kicked him out anyway. And 2.5 years later, seven people are dead,
mm-hmm.
at least. Mm-hmm. Probably more, but seven that he's been convicted of and spent the rest of his life in prison
mm-hmm.
for conspiring to commit.
Now, Charles, according to my references and resources here, Charles Manson's actual diagnosis or final diagnosis was antisocial personality disorder, which is typically what they usually give.
That was the
Charles Manson.
Yeah.
But some of Charles's behavior and the things that he said, I imagine it would be very difficult because Charles also used a lot of drugs,
mm-hmm.
a lot of hallucinogenics, LSD.
That was another way he controlled his family.
Yeah. So I guess it would be kind of hard, but he has some, or displays some symptoms of schizophrenia at times, but that could easily be the drugs that he was taking. So I guess it would be very difficult to, but he never received that diagnosis officially. According to my sources, his official diagnosis was antisocial personality disorder because of the violence, the lack of remorse, you know, we've talked about that on this
the show diagnosis
many times.
Du jour back in those days, right?
Basically for the population of people that we talk about here, you can hear that a lot. Mm-hmm. But I always go back through his childhood and kind of look at it, and it's very, very tragic to me. It's very sad. There are no winners.
He never had a chance to succeed in life.
I just think that I don't know where I would have ended up if that had been my childhood.
Yeah. Wow, that's a fair statement for any of us, I think. I mean, you bang your head against the wall so many times, and you just turn around and run the other way.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to make
an
excuse.
And you don't care where that is. You're just tired of this.
Right. I'm not trying to make an excuse, because I think anybody who's watched an interview with Charles Manson, when he would come up for parole occasionally and they would do those interviews with him, and basically he's telling them, if you let me out, I'm just going to go do the same thing. I always wondered if he did that on purpose so he could just stay, or if he truly believed that. I never could get a sense of which one that
maybe
was.
Maybe a little of both.
Could have been. So you see those interviews with Charles Manson, and you know this individual needs to be incarcerated forever. He does not need to see the light of day. And he never did.
Right.
He never did. But I often found myself wondering, is he so... I mean, he said he's institutionalized. Does he not want to be out? Does he want to continue this helter-skelter? Is it a little bit of both?
Yeah.
So,
I think everybody had too much fun in California in the late 60s. And he was just one of the many, unfortunately.
Goodness me. And I hate it. And so I'm glad that we've learned a little more about Sharon Tate, because she just gets always lost in the shuffle with this. You hear about her, but also the LaBiancas, they get completely lost
in
the shuffle. When you start talking about Manson, you know, the Sharon Tate name,
it always
will
ends
come
up, the focus always ends up back on Manson.
It is, but it didn't, the him and the followers and, and I'm glad to know that I learned about Sharon Tate, and I learned about Jay Sebring, and I learned about the LaBiancas, and I learned about
Frykowski and Folger.
And I enjoyed that part about that, and learning about the Alabama ties that I was unaware of both of those when we started this. Yeah. So I'm excited. I think you guys did an incredible job. Thank you so much for that. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook. Go to our website, truecrimeoneasystreet.com.
You forgot Twitter.
We're on Twitter as well.
That's true.
And I recently hear Tommy Lee was on Twitter making some waves recently.
Oh, Lord, I've missed this.
Yeah, you're going to have to fill
us
in on that.
Tommy Lee recently broke the internet trying to promote his
new
album.
He did that 20 years ago with another part of his anatomy.
It was that same anatomy.
Ah, the same part. Okay.
That same anatomy.
You can get some nudity on Twitter.
Has shown up on Twitter, and as I understand it, is still there and is causing a lot of stink. And that's happening in real time right now. So
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. That's what I was like.
Are we doing next? I mean, it's scary time coming up. Can we talk about anything that we're going to do, or are you going to poke me in the eyes with that pencil you're holding if I try to say anything?
We are not. I'm going to pull a Manson, and I'm going to jump over my table and come at you.
All right, never mind. You'll have to tune in next week to find out the next crazy thing we're going to do here on True Crime on Easy Street.
Yep.
Is that it? Are we done?
That's it.
Nothing else to talk about?
Nothing.
It seems weird, but whatever. Good night, everybody.